Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. Can I start by acknowledging the traditional owners of this land, the Ngunnawal people, paying my respects to their elders, past, present and future. In doing that, can I also just pick up on Brian's opening remarks, just highlighting the tens of thousands of years that Aboriginal people have been meeting on this land, and do so in asking you to reflect on that. Our shared history on this land has been a far shorter period of time, and developing a stronger shared understanding of that history and the impact of settlers on Aboriginal people in this country is fundamental to us building a better relationship between Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians and all of Australia, which in turn is essential to building trust and achieving genuine reconciliation. So every time I acknowledge country, that's what I ask other people to do as well. So in the spirit of that, let me again acknowledge that we meet on the land of the Ngunnawal peoples. Now onto a slightly different topic. Our session today is looking at the global economy. I'll introduce my panellists and then make some opening remarks. We are going to have each person speak for about 7 minutes and then leave plenty of time for interaction, conversation and debate. I fear if I open it up before everyone's spoken, we'll never get to everyone. So please, just a little bit of tolerance as we give everyone a chance to have their say, and then no doubt we'll have a very interesting conversation. To my immediate right is Su Lin Ong, who is the Managing Director of RBC Capital Markets, the Chief Economist and the Head of Australian Research. She's led the Economics and Fixed Income team since 2010 and now also sees Australian equity research. To her right is Philip Lowe, who is, of course, the Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia and will be well known to all of you in the room, so I won't say too much more about Philip. I should have said at the outset, in the forum app is all the background on everyone, so you can go and have a closer look there. Then we've got Tom Lembong, who is the Chair of the Indonesia Investment Coordinating Board and former Minister of Trade for Indonesia, but also was previously a managing partner in a private equity fund, so well placed to give us some insights today. And finally, at the end, Warwick McKibben, who is Professor of Public Policy and Director of the Centre for Applied Macroeconomic Analysis here at the Crawford School of Public Policy. Welcome, everyone. Now, just to set the scene a little bit, at the end of last year, we saw a correction in financial markets, a tightening of financial conditions, and I think that rattled more than a few people in terms of thinking about where our economy here and elsewhere was heading, and particularly started raising questions about vulnerabilities if economic growth was to deteriorate significantly. The IMF, in some of its most recent work, highlights that this year is a delicate one for the global economy, and has emphasised that an extended period of low interest rates and accommodative financial conditions has enabled and allowed vulnerabilities to build up. If you look at the US, corporate debt to GDP is at record highs. The profile of government debt is described as unsustainable by the IMF. And in the Eurozone and the US, the stock of speculative grade credit has almost doubled since the global financial crisis. And measures of political and policy uncertainty around the world have increased and remained very, very high. So that's a little bit of the scene setting for the context of our discussions today. Su Lin, over to you for a quick rundown on how you're seeing economic developments in markets recently.
So I thought I'd start with the global picture, and what we're seeing is really a much softer global economy. So growth globally has been moderating really over the last 12 months. We think it's running a little below 3%, so that's the slowest pace in global growth since the financial crisis. Global trade volumes are even weaker. There was a contraction in global trade both Q4 of last year and Q1. And we're expecting this subpar pace of activity to continue into 2020 with a number of risks. Now, there's a few reasons for why activity has slowed. As Melinda mentioned, we did see some tightening in financial conditions in both 17 and 18. We've seen a bit of a waning in US fiscal stimulus. Uncertainty over Brexit is another another reason, and obviously the increase in global protectionism as well. And I think what's a little worrying is in the last couple of months we've seen the global manufacturing cycle take quite a notable leg down, and we can see it in a number of the indicators. Some of them around the globe have moved into outright contractionary territory, others are losing momentum, and it seems fairly clear that there's a real weakening there. Now, this on the global manufacturing side, it is very much, we think, directly attributable to the rise in protectionism and the accompanying uncertainty. And we can see that fairly clearly. We can see it in the disruption to global supply chains. We see it in the heightened loss of business confidence, a paring back now of capital expenditure, and a weaker global capex cycle. So that's fairly clear. And the worry is that the weakness in global manufacturing spills over to broader services and broader growth. So there's a definite real softening going on. At some point, that may well pose a threat to labour markets. And what we do see really, and the good news has been particularly in G7 and a lot of the developed world, is that global labour markets have been in pretty good shape. We've had very low levels of unemployment, and we're starting to see some pickup in wages growth in certain parts of the world, but it's taken extraordinarily tight labour markets to get us there. And I guess, you know, and we'll debate this, but even when we can generate some wages growth, it's no guarantee that we'll see higher inflation. And the US is perhaps the best example of this. So, you know, in the US, we see a near historically long expansion, an unemployment rate that's down at a 50-year low, pretty dynamic and innovative economy, yet core inflation is 1.5%. So the Fed's preferred measure, PCE, 1.5%. Well below the Fed's target. That's all the inflation it's managed to generate. And so the global inflation pulse is pretty subdued as well. So, well, from our perspective and from what markets are focused on, there's many risks for the global economy, but I'd probably highlight two that are front and centre. Clearly, the rise in global protectionism is one. Economies that become more inward-looking, a weakening of global trade flows and investment. We wonder if we're a little bit at an inflection point here after decades of globalisation and freer trade. You know, is this quite a key point? And we wonder about that going forward. And it was alluded to last night in that great opening session, the US-China tariff situation is a lot more than just about trade, and it's part of the reason we fear there is no easy or quick solution. Markets in particular are very focused on this issue. I think it's in part because we have a US president that has a very unusual method of communication, and it's a bit random, and we seem to be kind of one tweet away from disaster at times, but it's quite unnerving for markets. And I think more broadly, it raises the question of a breakdown in the rules of global trade and engagement. Secondly, what markets are very worried about is whether there's enough global policy ammunition. Policy rates remain pretty low around the world. In some parts of the world, they are at near or historic lows. We think in particular China probably has less scope to stimulate now than it did 10 years ago, given the build-up of debt and a greater fragility in their financial system. And when we look across G7, Melinda, as you alluded to, we know debt levels are higher, government debt levels are higher, so fiscally they're a little bit more constrained. So it does beg the question of how much ammunition is there if the globe slows down significantly. For Australia, against this fairly challenging global backdrop, it hasn't transmitted through in the traditional way, so usually it would be via weaker growth, weaker China, via lower commodity prices in terms of trade and national income. We haven't actually seen that impact. In fact, since the middle of last year, it's probably been the opposite. Key commodity prices, particularly iron ore from supply side shock, have held up incredibly well, and that's been quite fortuitous. And so the weakening in the Australian growth pulse has been very much domestically generated. We think growth is running sub 2% here and will remain so over the course of 19, might pick up a little bit next year to around 2.5, but it is a persistent pace of sub-trend activity we think that we're looking at, and particularly for domestic demand, consumption and the dwelling sector, there are a number of challenges here. And ultimately, sub-trend growth is going to see a weakening or further weakening in labour markets, and that will be pretty critical. Rate cuts will help, but you know, we would argue that we need all arms of policy to be lifting here. And Australia's lucky, it has more fiscal scope than most, and it should be used in our view. So again, when we look at the risk to Australia, we would highlight two. The first is around elevated levels of household debt, historically high. They suggest that if we get an external shock, that's going to exacerbate the impact on the Australian economy. The second one, and it's maybe one that's maybe not as obvious, is without an external shock, you know, we could be just facing a period of just what we call slow growth funk, just subpar growth, very low wages and inflation. It's not terrible, but it's not great. And in that environment, we worry that it's not conducive to reform. It's not conducive to measures to improve competitiveness. It doesn't change the way we skill our labour. And all of that is really key because, you know, where does the next leg of growth come from if we don't have a sustained lift in productivity? So for us, that's very much what we're focused on. And I guess finally, I'd just finish my comments in terms of financial markets. I'm a little bit biased because I work in rates, but I think that bond markets are telling you something, and quite significantly as well. So from what I've learnt in markets over time is they kind of overshoot a bit, they get a little bit excited, they don't always get the timing right, but they generally get the direction right, and that reflects macro concerns and policy concerns. And they're telling us that there's three, I think, important developments that bear watching. The first is around increased expectations of rate cuts from the G7. This has ratcheted up quite considerably, particularly in the last few weeks. Markets are looking for the Fed to deliver 100 points of cuts over the next 12 months, as soon as at least 25 in July, maybe 50 is a bit of speculation, looking for ECB to cut. And if you remember, the ECB depo rate is actually minus 0.5 already, so we're talking about fairly desperate measures here. Bank of Canada has expectations of 1.5 cuts over the next 12 months. Clearly, there are expectations here as well. Even the Bank of Japan is talking about greater flexibility. So, you know, increasingly, global central banks sound more dovish and they sound less confident in meeting their objectives.
So, a good chance now to toss to the governor. I guess Julian's raised a particular view around where Australia's at, where the globe feels like it's heading, and question, you know, the amount of global policy ammunition, particularly on the monetary policy side. So how is the RBA seeing things? And by the way, you can answer this later as a question on notice. If and when are you going to adopt the tweeting approach of the US president to influencing markets in Australia? But
well, I can answer that now. I'm not. Well, thanks, Melinda. It's great to be back at the Crawford Forum. I was last here 2 years ago, and I remember Ken Henry asking me a question about wages. And the forum 2 years ago was the first time that I started talking about the very low wage growth in the economy and how that was a significant issue. So it's great to be back. I want to start off with the global economy, and to remind you, it's really important we keep perspective here. 2 weekends ago, I was at the G20 meeting of governors and finance ministers in Japan, and the IMF was telling us that next year the global economy was supposed to is likely to be better than it was this year. So they're predicting 3.6% growth next year and 3.3% this year. So the IMF, who is often prone to negativity, is saying, well, things could be a little better next year. It's true the global economy has slowed, but it's still reasonable. We wish it were better, but it's still reasonable. I think we need to keep that in perspective. The other major theme at the G20 conference was that the risks are tilted to the downside. And the main risk is the uncertainty that's being generated by the trade and technology disputes between the US and China. And in Europe, you could add to this the uncertainty that's generated by Brexit. This uncertainty is now having a major effect on investment around the world. Investment plans are weakening and capital spending is declining. In a way, it's not surprising because uncertainty increases the option value of waiting. And what we're seeing right around the world is firms wait before deciding to undertake investment. They're sitting on their hands. And if enough people sit on their hands, then it's going to have a major effect on the global economy. It's interesting at the moment, firms, while they're not wanting to invest, are very happy to hire people. So the unemployment rate in the United States is the lowest in 50 years, in the UK it's the lowest in 40 years, in Germany 30 years, in Japan 30 or 40 years. So employment growth is strong, the services sector is strong, people are consuming, but businesses are not investing. And it's understandable, they're sitting on their hands, they're waiting for the uncertainty about the trade and technology disputes to be resolved. It's an open question about whether that will happen. If it doesn't happen, then I think firms will not only decide not to invest, but they might decide not to hire people as well, and we could be looking at a much weaker global economy. So it's, for me, that's the really big issue. Can the uncertainty around technology and trade be resolved? A question that was posed in the written material for this session was, are we likely to face another global financial crisis? And in my view, that's quite unlikely. And I say that because the financial system is much stronger than it was a decade ago. Capital levels are much higher. Liquidity ratios are much higher. Bank balance sheets are simpler. The financial structuring that took place a while ago is not there, so balance sheets are less opaque. So the financial system looks a lot stronger than it was a decade ago. So I don't think we're going to see the financial amplification and the financial shock that we saw a decade ago. The weakest spot is the European banks. The market value of their assets is significantly less than the book value, which says that investors don't really believe the value of those assets. And if we have a downturn in Europe, then that uncertainty about the value of bank assets in Europe could become quite an issue, but at the moment it looks okay. So the other question posed, and you posed this as well, Melinda, what are the possible policy responses if things do slow? And here there's good news and bad news. The good news is that we do have policy options, and the bad news is most of the policy options that we have face significant constraints and complications, and I'll run you through some of those. So if we start off with monetary policy, as the downside risks have come into sharper focus recently, markets are now pricing in cuts in interest rates in all the major jurisdictions. Sue Lin said in the US, the markets are now pricing in 4 cuts in interest rates over the next year. And the euro area, they're now markets are pricing in cuts again after the ECB's rate has been held steady for a long period of time, and markets are now pricing in cuts. And the same is true in Japan, where their rate is minus 10 basis points. So that's quite a big shift in just 3 months with the US, the ECB and the Bank of Japan all expected to cut rates over the next year. And that's all despite the central scenario for the global economy being quite reasonable. And as the IMF says, probably a bit stronger next year than this year. And I think what's happening is the uncertainty that's affecting investment intentions around the world is now affecting market sentiment. Markets have become very nervous about the outlook because they're looking at the uncertainty generated by the trade and technology disputes as well. But investors also seem to think that central banks will ride to the rescue once again. So if you look at equity markets, they're very strong. If you look at credit spreads, they're very narrow. So the same investors who are worried about the future aren't worried about the kind of future profits of companies or credit risk in companies. So for me, it's a strange world. The outlook markets, investors view the outlook sufficiently weak that they expect central banks right around the world to cut interest rates, but they're not worried about corporate profits or credit risk. I don't really understand that fully. It's a legitimate question to ask how effective further monetary easing would be. If you've just got a single country and it eases monetary policy, one of the main benefits you get from that is a weaker exchange rate. It improves the trade position. So the exchange rate channel is an important channel through which monetary easing stimulates growth. But if everyone's easing, there is no exchange rate channel. We trade with one another, we don't trade with Mars. So if everyone's easing, the effect that we get from exchange rate depreciation, that part of the transmission mechanism, isn't there, so we don't get the same stimulus that you would normally expect from monetary easing. It might be possible if you ease a bit more than others that you get a bit, but that's you get a bit extra growth, but that's quite a dangerous path to go down. And that leaves the other transmission mechanisms for monetary policy, which in my view are weaker at the moment. So it's not realistic to expect stronger growth from exchange rate depreciation globally, and the other transmission mechanisms, I think, are quite weak. So there are limits on what further monetary easing can achieve. I think we can still get benefit from it, but there are limits. In my mind, that means that we need to focus on fiscal policy and structural reforms. It's true that public debt is quite high in a number of countries, but it's not so high that it should rule out further fiscal expansion if the global economy slows. And I've long been talking about the benefits of infrastructure investment. In our economy, it would benefit the demand side of the economy, and it would add to the productive capacity of the nation. And there tend to be quite high multipliers from public investment in infrastructure. So in Australia, but also globally, I think there's a lot to be said from further spending on infrastructure. So I think governments just here and right around the world should have their top drawers full of really good ideas that are shovel-ready in case global growth slows. I think increased spending on infrastructure and fiscal expansion in the current environment is going to be better than further monetary easing. And we need to remember that interest rates at the moment are at record lows. I think the 10-year bond rate in Australia today is the lowest it's been since Federation, 1.3%. And the whole government yield curve in Australia is below 2%. The Australian government can borrow, for 28 years at just less than 2%. There must be projects out there that yield risk-adjusted rates of return greater than 2%, particularly given the strong population growth in Australia. So both Australia and elsewhere around the world, I think we need to be thinking of ways of capitalising on that and building on the infrastructure, adding to demand, increasing the supply capacity of the country, and we can do it at low interest rates. But beyond fiscal expansions, I think the best policies are those that reduce uncertainty and that create a positive environment for firms to invest, expand, innovate and hire people. It's not easy to do, but it's not impossible. And there are so many reports in Australia and right around the world that tell us the areas to be looking at. They include the incentives in the tax system for innovation and entrepreneurship, the way we train our workforce and equip them with skills of the future, the way we tax land, wealth generation and consumption, the way we deliver public services, the framework that underpins strong competition in our markets, and the provision and pricing of infrastructure and the processes that we use to select which projects. So these are the areas that both the domestic and the Australian, the domestic and the international evidence suggests we should be looking at. None of them are easy, but if we work on enough of these areas, then I'm confident that we can create an environment where firms feel sufficiently positive that they will invest, they will hire, they will innovate, and they will expand. And that's going to be a much better approach than further monetary easing globally or further fiscal expansion. None of those areas are easy, but they're possible to work on, and I think if we work on those, then we can make a difference. Ultimately, that's the only durable way to increase our living standards. We can't do that through monetary policy or fiscal expansion. Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. An awful lot in there. I hope everyone's scribbling notes and questions for later, because I've got a few. Tom, Indonesia has been a country that's been significantly impacted in the last little while by what's been happening globally around financial conditions, tightening of financial conditions there, capital outflow, currency depreciation. How are you seeing things from your perspective? And what do you think are the big risks ahead for Indonesia and other emerging market economies?
Thank you, Melinda. So I think to go straight to the two questions, which are the themes of this session. First, are we facing a serious prospect of another global economic crisis? My answer would be definitively, unequivocally, yes. Second, are our governments and central banks equipped to meet the challenges that we will face? My answer again would be absolutely, definitively, unequivocally, no, we're not. We're not ready. But don't worry. Let me...
Sorry, I just have to intervene there. So hang on. So are we facing another GFC-like crisis? Yes. Do we have the tools to deal with it? No. But don't worry.
Yes.
So do I leave? Okay. Do I leave now?
Because this is an entirely normal set of affairs. Right? This is what we call life on the edge, or has otherwise been termed the new normal. I believe that the world economy is powered, and capital markets are powered by confidence, right? Or what Nobel Prize winning economist Robert Shiller called animal spirits. But I also believe that this confidence and animal spirits is subject to very strong, what I call cliff effects, right? So basically, everything is going swimmingly until suddenly they're not, right? So crises often happen at the height of economic success, when suddenly confidence falls off a cliff, right? And the reality is, if you look at history over the last two big crises, Asian financial crisis 1997, 98, and the Lehman crisis 2008, no, we're never ready when these crises come, because they are so unexpected. They do happen with confidence suddenly falling off a cliff, and only in hindsight do we see what it is exactly that freaked markets out and caused contagion across sectors or geographies. I think the good news is, as Governor Low has pointed out, the world economy is actually not doing so badly. So I personally actually belong to that school of thought that believes that we have a econometric measurement problem. A lot of the benefits of technology and globalization and so on are somehow not captured in the official statistics. And to give you an example, we're all aware of the e-commerce revolution. We're all aware about the internet revolution, social media, Netflix, and so on, and all the wonderful things which are so cheap today, which only 10 or 20 years ago, you would not have been able to buy at any price, right? And I believe these consumer benefits are somehow not captured in the official statistics, except as deflation, because everything seems to be getting cheaper all the time, or prices are not going up. Well, again, just briefly, I believe economists divide deflation into good deflation and bad deflation, right? I actually think there's a lot of good deflation in the system. However, I also acknowledge that in a world awash with debt and rising debt, deflation is a real threat, right? The good news is, again, I think the world economy is actually doing pretty well. What I see as happening is, however, more and more of the official economy is moving into the unofficial economy or the informal economy, like the online economy or e-commerce, where we not only are not able to regulate or tax our consumers, we don't even know what the hell they're doing, right? So I think at the same time that the official trade statistics show declines or softness, I believe, and Governor Low would love to hear your view on this, I believe financial flows are pretty robust. So my theory is that a lot of remittances or transfers of money are actually trade, but we don't know that it's trade. I'll give you an example. 4 years ago, as trade minister, one of my visits here in Australia was to a startup called Freelancer.com. Right, and I was astonished to be told by the founder that there's tens of thousands of Indonesians who are selling their services, like illustration, graphics, animation, architectural renderings, on freelancer.com. Right? Now, we have no idea that that was happening, right? But it's a new growth engine in the Indonesian economy, and we're not gonna register that as a service export, because we're not aware it's happening. But clearly, our Indonesian citizens selling these services are getting paid. So we are recording inflows. But we might guess that those are remittances, when in fact, they're actually service exports, right? So the bad news is we're only, you know, ever one stone's throw away from crisis. The good news is the world economy, actually, thanks to technology, globalization, youth, is actually doing quite well. The other bad news is I personally also believe that that these crises sort of come in cycles. And the last time was 1997-98 Asian financial crisis, and then 2008 was roughly 11 years later, 10 years later. And the Lehman crisis was 2008, and it's now 11 years later. So arguably we're overdue, Governor. And as Melinda, you cited the IMF report, right? There are imbalances and vulnerabilities building up. The problem is, as regulators, we just often don't know what they are and where they are until after the fact, right, after they've burst, right? But rest assured that us enterprising bankers and private equity and hedge fund people are always, you know, looking to arbitrage a system and building up, you know, imbalances and bubbles along the way. I think the world central bankers have done an admirable job of deflating gently the technology bubble, right? So Uber, you know, was aiming for a valuation of $120 billion at IPO. Right, and then the pricing was adjusted downward to like about $80 billion. You know, it's now trading at $70 billion. Right, so some investors are actually sitting on losses. So I think my conspiracy theory is the world central bankers sort of want to gently deflate this technology bubble because technology is helping to drive economic growth. Right, but we don't want to burst it. Right, and I think I'm astonished how remarkably successful you've been, Governor, around the world. So congratulations on that. Back to bad news, I think whilst there's been remarkable policy success and boldness, I think it's fair to say ECB Governor Draghi, and his team really saved the euro when the rubber hit the road way back when, was it 2015 or something, right? With the famous, whatever it takes, we shall do whatever it takes, Ben Bernanke and team, you know, genuinely saved the U.S. economy and world economy whenever it hit the roads. But I think the next time the crisis hits, we'll need even more boldness, even more innovation in policy at a time when, you know, this much power in the hands of central banks and in the age of populism is probably not sustainable, right? Yep. Some more accountability or communication and, unfortunately, less technocratic, more, you know, man of the people, street language is probably what's going to be required to implement the kind of incredibly bold and innovative policy measures that will be required when the next crisis strikes 3 months from now.
Right.
or 3 years from now. It's so, the only problem.
So Warwick, this.
Well, I would be astonished if we have successfully abolished financial crises forever. So
Warwick, I think there's a few challenges, and I was trying to draw Warwick into talking about modelling. He was telling me that's boring, but the challenge has been thrown your way. But so, in all seriousness, where are you seeing the vulnerabilities? I mean, I think one of the issues with low interest rates is this concern that people are chasing risk without necessarily wanting to disclose it as they're looking for return and yield. Yeah. Do you think vulnerabilities are building up? What do you think they are and how should we respond to them?
So I do want to respond to the original question. Do I think models are failing? And I think simple models are failing, but more complex models make you think about what are the key issues in the global economy. And I think what's missing, and I agree with all the comments, but I think what's missing and what I'd like to do in my 7 minutes is to give an overarching view of what's happening in the world, because I think that really matters. Yeah. So what we're seeing are two major drivers in the global economy. We're seeing massive change globally driven by the emergence of poorer countries becoming richer, billions of people entering the global economy. We're also seeing very large technological innovation. Now, this is very disruptive, and I want you to take away 3 points from what I'm about to say. The first point is it's very important to distinguish between what's happening to trends versus cycles. And I think there's a confusion that something that looks like a cycle might be a trend or vice versa. Secondly, there is both positive and negative disruption. So I'm optimistic that if you can get it right, there's an enormous amount of wealth out there that's being generated. And thirdly, I think the institutions and the policy approaches that we currently have are designed for the world of the 20th century. They're not designed for the world today. And there has to be big changes in the way we think about the world going forward. So there are three points, and let me dig a little bit deeper into each of those. The difference between trends and cycles. I think most of what we're observing is actually big shifts in trends to do with productivity, to do with demographics, etc. And I think policymakers are treating it as if it's a cyclical adjustment. And they're trying to use monetary policy to smooth out a trend reduction, which it cannot do. So I think the problem there is what we've ended up with is an enormous amount of government debt. We've ended up with an enormous misallocation of global capital because central banks, fiscal authorities and other organisations have pushed the world economy in the direction for the wrong shock. And so that led to a vulnerability. Secondly, positive versus negative disruption. There are two things happening here. There's a lot of countries who are catching up to the frontier. There's a lot of countries just using things that we know how to do, but implementing them locally. And that's leading to economic growth in China and India and in Latin America. But the new technologies are actually potentially going to generate all sorts of enormous wealth. And the problem we have is that when you have these big shifts, existing capital, human capital, physical capital, social capital, natural capital will be revalued and leads to very big disruptions in the value of that capital. Secondly, what this disruption does is it reduces the cost of doing business. And we've already talked about this. So we have both the technological innovations reducing the cost of doing business. We have globalisation, means that you can buy things cheaper overseas than at home. We have changing market structures. The size of firms are changing. And what this means is that the implied inflation rate during this very big transition is going to be very low. And that has implications for how you think about monetary policy. And the third disruption is that you're getting a lot of changes in income inequality. So by not dealing with these big structural issues early on, governments have allowed big shifts in income inequality within countries, which has driven political disruption. And we have the emergence of the extreme left and the extreme right and the breakdown of political consensus. So what does this mean for institutions? Well, I think, for example, and I don't want to be controversial here at all, but I think the idea that central banks should target inflation today is the wrong framework. I think the idea that fiscal policy should be all about balancing budgets, no matter what, is the wrong concept. I think the idea that that you want to use climate and energy policies and industrial policies looking backwards to try and keep old industries alive, to try and keep old firms alive, and even to try and keep old regions alive, is actually the wrong way to think about it. We're in a dynamically changing system and you need to look forward and you need to allow the adjustment to occur because it's much more costly to try and prevent it. So just to drive a little bit deeper into why I think it's trends rather than cycles. What drives economic growth? Demography, human, natural, social and physical capital accumulation and productivity. And that's what's driving the big trends in the world economy. What we're seeing in demographics, we're seeing slowing of population growth. We're seeing ageing of populations. We're seeing investment in human capital that's probably gone into the wrong sorts of human capital for the world in which the people coming into the workforce will need. So human capital investments haven't been appropriate. National capital is being depleted. And when you put these together, and Phil made this point, firms are not investing. They're not investing because they're uncertain about future growth. They're uncertainty about future government policy. They're uncertainty about a lack of consensus between the two sides of politics in most countries about what policies they think the country should be following. And so you have this negative policy approach rather than consensus policy approach. You have complete lack of guidance in policies in the key areas of energy and climate change, tax policy, and then you have on top of that the small problem of President Trump's trade policy, and you have this enormous amount of government debt and private debt in the global system. So that's why firms aren't investing. Why are real interest rates so low? Well, global savings is higher than global investment because people are scared about the future and they're saving. Firms are not investing for reasons of disgust. So we have low real interest rates. So I just want to conclude by drawing out two areas where I think some really interesting questions we need to ask based on research, some of which is already published this year and some which is be published later at the end of the year. The two areas I want to bring out is what's happening with productivity growth, and the second is the serious problem of antimicrobial resistance. And that is something which is completely underappreciated. So why is productivity growth falling when you see new technology everywhere? Now, I think that is a puzzle when you start to think about it, but when you then start digging into what's going on, it's less of a puzzle. Now, there's lots of reasons why we think productivity growth is weak. One is a measurement issue. Maybe we're just not measuring it properly. Maybe it's hard to measure the impact of new products or of improved quality products on prices and quantities. Market structures are changing, so we've got mega firms buying up small innovative firms and then closing down the innovative process, destroying innovation because of the market structures. We have too many zombie firms in many countries because central banks have implemented unconventional policy, which have kept firms alive who should have died during the financial crisis. These low productive firms are bringing down the average productivity. The most interesting explanation, which is what we explored in our new research, which is on the Crawford website and is coming out at Brookings later in the year, is how does the innovation in technology impact on productivity in practice? And there's a lot of interesting work looking at all of the technological revolutions in history to see how long did it take for the technology, automobiles, electricity, waste management, sanitation, telephones, how long did it take for the technologies to actually change productivity? And if you look at it, it's an interesting hypothesis by people at Bell Labs and others. There's this critical level of a platform of where technology builds and builds and builds, and when it gets to a certain level in society, everybody's taking it up, and then you get the productivity surge. And if you look at it, the time period has been getting shorter and shorter. So Microsoft, it took a long time for Microsoft to be a consensus system. When it did, productivity from computers showed up in the data. And so I think what's interesting then is it may be, looking forward, that we're not looking at a period of continuously low productivity. It may well be we're looking at the beginning of a period of enormous productivity growth because the technologies that we're seeing in artificial intelligence and other new technologies are actually about to hit the system. How do we respond to that? And the paper with Adam Triggs, which we just put up on the internet, we look at what happens if that technology surge only happens in some countries and not all? What if it only happens in some sectors but not all? Each one of these scenarios has very, very different implications for the global macroeconomy and for the impacts on Australia and other countries. The second issue I just touched upon, I won't talk about it, but we've got a new report coming out building on Jim O'Neill's work in 2017, looking at the impact of microbial resistance. And we've added the impact on agriculture and morbidity, mortality, etc. You look at that in any serious way, and for example, in Africa, 80% of tuberculosis now is completely resistant to antibiotics. Now, if you look at scaling up the resistance, you can wipe out, our research shows you can wipe out $150 trillion cumulative dollars, US dollars, out of the world economy between now and 2050. And we're doing almost nothing about it. So that's actually a very negative productivity shock, which is in place now. And we're talking about should interest rates be 1% or 1.25%. And so there are some big issues there I think we need to worry about. Just to conclude then, I'm quite optimistic that we can undertake this massive transformation of the global global humanity, but I just don't think from a pessimistic viewpoint that we have the economic, political or social institutions fit for purpose to deal with the amount of change that's going on. And in my view, and to answer the question of the conference, how can trust be improved? It can only be improved if people acknowledge what the problem is and then actually offer the appropriate solutions to that particular problem, not coming up with some other problem which is actually not a problem at all and the policy responses are inappropriate.
Well, thank you, Warwick. There is so much in there, I don't even know how to summarise. I didn't think we were going to end up with microbial resistance, I have to say, but thank you for raising it. You've heard enough from us, so now's the time for questions, comments, thoughts. I can keep going if you like, but I'm sure there's people in the audience who are interested. If you are, just raise your hand and then introduce yourself and fire away. The back here, thank you.
Yeah, Matt Benson from the Review. Phil, I just wanted to ask you, you've been pushing the cheap funding story, you know, lowest funding since Federation. Are you sort of slightly suggesting also that maybe the government should take on more debt and rethink having to keep a surplus?
Now, my main point really is about infrastructure investment. And if the government can build productive capacity by borrowing at low interest rates, it seems like that's a good thing to do, as long as there are good projects out there. And given how fast the population's been growing over a long period of time and chronic underinvestment in infrastructure, I conjecture that there are a lot of projects out there that would yield a risk-adjusted rate of return greater than 2%. And if there are, and the government can borrow to finance those, that seems like a good thing to do, especially at a time when the economy needs extra demand, which it does at the moment. So it's not a comment about the plans for a budget surplus. I think you can do part of this infrastructure investment off budget, and now's the time to do it.
If you look at what the New South Wales government is doing, New South Wales Treasurer was very explicit in referencing an interest rate of 1.8% and the rate of return they expect on their generations fund of CPI plus 3.5-4%. So it's exactly where their thinking is at. We've got a question over here.
Could I just add one
sorry,
Warwick? Because I think it's important. The fixation with the deficit is a problem. What you want to worry about is your current spending relative to the revenue flows which can sustain it. What Phil's talking about, which I also argued, is that you want to distinguish the capital account where you can borrow against that and have a rate of return that more than services the debt.
Yeah.
So the fixation with the aggregate budget deficit is just misplaced. Mm. It's got to be separated, current versus capital, reliable revenue streams versus make-believe revenue streams.
Can I also put another plug in that the New South Wales Treasurer made really strongly was that they're very focused on outcomes. So whether it's capital or on budget spending for their expenditure programs, they're looking for better outcomes for everything. So every dollar they spend, they're now wanting to see the results for it.
And it has to be evaluated by an independent agency, by the way, not just dumped into the economy because some electorate needs to have a new football field.
Yes, I mean, I think, can I just add to that? Because I think that's really important, project selection. You know, the pricing of the use of infrastructure, the management of the construction costs and the project selection, really important issues. And if we don't get those right, then the public doesn't trust the government to build infrastructure because they see it being driven by political considerations. So the governance of infrastructure is really important. It's just not about spending money.
Yep. So question over here, I think.
Thanks. Andrew Lee from the Australian Parliament. Warwick, I wanted to push you a little bit more on the productivity question, and particularly some of this new data that's been coming out this year from Treasury and other researchers. The new business start-up rate seems to have fallen 15% in 2005, now down to 9%. Worker job switching between firms is falling. Dan Andrews' work out of Treasury seems to suggest that Australia's falling off the global productivity frontier. To what extent have we got a set of policies that are too focused in the small business area on supporting bonsai firms rather than on new firms? And to what extent is problems like low uptake of data or poor management practices a real challenge for Australia's productivity agenda?
So, I mean, that's very much... Thanks, Andrew. That's very much a microeconomic issue. I think that the things we're seeing in Australia are actually global phenomena. We're seeing these declining in productivity. Dan Andrews' work at the OECD across all countries is actually very consistent with the Australian data. We have unique sets of characteristics here. I think we have lack of access to nationwide infrastructure through the NBN. I think that was a big mistake, the NBN. I think the technology is being surpassed by 5G and more better technology, more flexible technology. So I think there's a whole bunch of regulatory problems with small businesses. I run a small business in Australia. I run a software company. I'm forever filling out forms. I used to get the R&D tax credit, but it was costing me more to pay people to fill out the forms than it was to get the revenue, so I stopped that. So I think there's a lot of regulatory red tape, state and federal. I think there's a lot of things we can do, but there are these big mega issues in Australia that's consistent with the global issue. When do you take up technology? It's like a personal question. When do I upgrade my computer? It's very expensive to upgrade your computer. You wait until you really have to. And a lot of small firms are facing that same set of issues. When do you adopt the new technology? It's changing so quickly. The depreciation rates are rising very sharply. And so there's a lot of decisions that need to be made in very rapid succession. But your work on this has also been important, so I agree with that work that you've published.
Tom? If I can add to that, your comment, Warwick, makes me think of a J.P. Morgan research piece on Indonesia where one phrase caught my eye, which is that these microeconomic issues are morphing to become macroeconomic issues, right? So you add up enough microeconomic issues and they start to suffocate the economy, right? And that's why you also reference red tape. And I personally believe that's a major reason holding back small businesses, large companies can afford to hire armies of lawyers and consultants to process all this paperwork, but small two-person, seven-person shops cannot. Mm. So they just give up. Or, as I said, move to the informal sector of the economy, online, where the government doesn't even know what they're doing, and hence we are not inflicting stacks and stacks of forms on them, right? So they're moving, they're migrating. But, and here comes my pitch for Indonesia in a subtle way. Talking about monetary stimulus and fiscal stimulus, we're one of the few countries which are constitutionally limited from running a budget deficit more than 3% per year of GDP, right? So the fiscal stimulus option is simply not available to us. At the same time, if we were to implement monetary stimulus by printing rupiah, our currency exchange rate would collapse, right? So the monetary stimulus is not available to us either, unless it's accommodated by the major central banks all easing at the same time, or enough of them easing at the same time so that it becomes safe for us to ease. That leaves only what the Shinzo Abe government of Japan calls the third arrow, namely structural reform. And it will be, I think, for the entirety of my career, my passion and obsession is to push structural reforms like debureaucratization, cutting red tape, right? Getting bipartisan or multipartisan consensus for infrastructure and labor market reforms and the like. And that's what President Jokowi has been pushing. In fact, this afternoon there's two cabinet meetings that I'm missing to be here. One on revising our labor law to make our labor markets more flexible, more dynamic, right? Make it easier to hire and fire people, among other things, but also make it easier for people to intern, right? That's a kind of flexibility. And second cabinet meeting is on a $3 billion port in West Java, which will have a giant car terminal, which will enable us to export more cars and also import more cars, right? So infrastructure, structural reforms. Now, lastly, my pitch is that, you know, if you look at the data, if you look at the evidence, structural reform actually has a very fast payback. My estimate is about 3 years, right? So this notion that reform doesn't pay off politically, in my view, is a myth. What happens is, the trick to doing it is, you have to do it immediately up front, at the beginning of your term, right? Because assuming you have a four-year term, that might be shortened to 3 years, or a five-year term in the case of Indonesia, as long as you start immediately, you will see the payoff before the next election. The problem starts is when you dilly-dally, and you delay by 12 months, 18 months, and then you panic and you put reforms, then you know you inflict all the pain and controversy, but you don't see the results before the next election. That's when the problem starts, right? But really, moving quickly is key, and payoff from reform is actually very, very fast.
So I think we've just got a pitch for election reform here in Australia. Now, I've got a question here, a question there. Question there. So here, thank you.
Look, thank you for raising microbial resistance. I think it really is interesting for us to think about global economy more broadly. As Warwick well knows, there's a project called the State of the Tropics, which does in fact look at what's happening in the development terms across the tropics overall, between the Tropic of Cancer and Capricorn. And to go to your point about the importance of demography, what we know is that it's more than 40% of the world's population lives in the tropics right now, about 55% of the world's children. The estimates are that by the end of the 2040s, it's going to be more than half of the world's population and 67% of the world's children. And we know that there are major health effects and major developmental effects that are going on right now, as far as that's concerned. This project released a report 2 years ago on sustainable infrastructure development in the tropics. Next week is going to be a thematic report on health in the tropics, and the next broad brush report, which is going to answer again a question which was first posed in a report in 2014, is life in the tropics getting better, will be answered again to check progress. So this Saturday is the International Day of the Tropics, UN International Day of the Tropics. 75 nations of the world determined that there should be one. So I guess my key point is, you know, one, to draw attention to that particular endeavour, that's a worldwide endeavour that's going on right now, but just to say that if we are talking about the global economy, what happens in the tropics will in no small way affect the rest of the world. So I think we're absolutely right to look at health effects, development effects, infrastructure development effects, as well as education. Thank you.
Craig.
No, so I do know that report. It's on my shelf, and I've talked to you, Sandra, about this, and I think it's very important work.
If you pass this way, we'll... There you go.
Pass the mic.
Yeah. I'd give you mine, but it would be too convoluted.
It really is just a question of a bit of detail on what you were saying earlier, Phil, about infrastructure, Andrew's question, and I think a couple of others. The Grattan Institute did a pretty major report on Australia's modern history in infrastructure investment, and I concluded that it was uniformly bad. I think they found virtually no exceptions to the rule that the wrong infrastructure was upgraded or created. How can we kind of avert what otherwise is inevitable, and that is that politicians will say this is really attractive, it's in a marginal seat or whatever. How can we get independent analysis by some sort of semi-autonomous organisation such as Infrastructure Australia or something like that, so that when we do go into these situations, you said you hoped that there would be shovel-ready projects. The only ones I can think of, frankly, are widening existing roads, like accelerating that. Presumably the work's been done on that. But I'm just not confident, and I wonder if anyone has any views as to whether there are good infrastructure projects out there, and if there aren't, how we can create the institutional systems to make sure that there are whenever we need to invest in them.
Well, I think the issue is really the governance of project selection. Mm. And how do we get that right? And if we don't get it right, the public doesn't trust the politicians to spend our money. So it's insidious if we don't get the governance right. I don't know the answer to this, but some more independence of project selection from the political process would be a good idea. I think there's a parallel with monetary policy. 30 years ago, it was considered just kind of crazy to give people like me and my board the power to set interest rates. It was too important. It needed to be done by the government. And the society correctly decided that we got suboptimal outcomes by leaving those decisions just to the politicians, and you're better off giving them to people like me and my board. You get better outcomes over time, and I think the same logic can be used for infrastructure selection and finding a way that the public can have confidence that the right projects are selected, the construction costs are managed, and the pricing of infrastructure is done properly. The world faces a lot of problems, but that isn't the biggest one we face. I think kind of with the right application, we can solve that. And it requires political...
Tom, just before I go to you, let me just... I was really surprised, just on theme, I was really surprised after the last federal budget that no one actually pulled out the Infrastructure Australia priority list and ran the ruler over what was selected and what was on that priority list. And then when I spoke to someone about it, their question was, well... is the priority, did they still produce a priority list? And so they do. And when we talk about accountability and challenge and, I mean, I was really struck by that, that it was just accepted that the projects were what they were and that no one in the media anywhere even went back and had a look at, did these line up with any of the priority lists from Infrastructure Australia or Infrastructure Victoria or Infrastructure wherever? And we've got to the point where people just don't even seem to expect that that ruler should be run over projects.
I've been arguing for what Phil just spoke about for about 3 years now, and that's a semi-autonomous... It could be overruled, right? Mm. If the Parliament said, we're going to overrule this project, then go to explain that to the people, but have effectively an arm of fiscal policy residing at or near the Reserve Bank, which is the infrastructure projects that... Yep.
So Tom and then we've got about 65 questions. So.
Okay, briefly, I think this kind of autonomous body of eminent persons and robust public debate around infrastructure is really critical right now because to Warwick's point, we're on the cusp of transformational infrastructure changes such as autonomous vehicles, drone delivery, and even, believe it or not, flying cars and flying trucks, right? Electrically powered flying cars. So with all due respect, sir, widening the roads, right? Soon we'll be having exactly several layers of aerial lanes going vertical. I agree with Warwick, and I think in the previous session moderated by Laura Tingle, was to talk about deregulation. The problem is not more regulation or less regulation. We're regulating things that we shouldn't be regulating, and we're not regulating the things which we should be regulating, right? And same with antimicrobial resistance, which I strongly agree with. We're fighting and arguing over things that just frankly don't matter, and we're not focusing on the things that really do matter, which are in almost a crisis state like the antimicrobial resistance. But yes, lest we spend trillions of dollars on 20th century infrastructure when we're on the cusp of 21st century. You know, so Indonesia is now running a pilot drone delivery of blood supply and medical supply. It's a Silicon Valley startup called Zipline. Mm. They now deliver 100% of the blood supply and medical emergency supplies in Rwanda, right? It's a fixed-wing, electrically powered drone, autonomous, about the size of a conference table, and they deliver by parachute, right? So they fly out and they drop the delivery package via parachute. 100% on-time track record, 100% reliability track record, right? So, you know, as we think about more roads and so on, and bridges, you know, and then autonomous cars, I believe the first stage will actually not be transporting humans, but will actually be transporting cargo, right? Mm-hmm. So we need to think about the roads in terms of, you know, just like maybe some decades ago, we started putting in bike lanes, right? Maybe we need to put sort of autonomous vehicle lanes that will deliver cargo, right? Like smaller, you know, the size of this table to deliver groceries or even like little R2-D2 things that deliver. Those are already operating, by the way, in London, in small towns outside of London and in small towns outside of Washington, D.C. So, you know.
So forward-looking, we must be. Now, Mitch, behind you, there's a person who's going to ask a question, and then I'm going to ask her to hand you the microphone.
Okay. Thanks, Melinda, and thank you also for your wonderful acknowledgement of country. It's such an important protocol, and I believe we should always do that. My name's Lisa Anise. I'm the CEO of the Diversity Council Australia. And my question to the panel is that we know at DCA that there's a massive group of underutilised potential in the form of half the population being gender. We know that, and that's not just the work of DCA, it's supported by the work of the AICD, by Boston Consulting Group, by McKinsey, by the Male Champions of Change. We know that there's a massive gap of underutilised female potential through part-time work, through casualisation through the gender pay gap. I'm interested from the panel, what do you think needs to be done so we can capitalise on that missed opportunity that we know will contribute to the country's GDP? Thank you.
I can probably start on that. I mean, absolutely, you know, when we look at what drives longer-term living standards and potential growth, participation is key. It's one of those three golden P's. And being able to lift participation rates for females right across the board, you know, in all stages of life is very key. And that requires, I think, a lot of effort broadly from policymakers and from individual workplaces. And we're starting to see some progress, but clearly there's a lot more to be done. But it's about measures to keep participation high and rising. It's about supporting women when they take time out from work. It's about stronger institutions in terms of supporting childcare and how that works into the taxation system. But it's really around those measures, particularly, you know, given the demographics and the ageing population and the strains that's going to place. So that's what it's about. I don't think we can entirely rely on governments to put that into place. If we all do that, we'll be waiting quite a long time. So it comes down, I think, to individual workplaces. And there, I know a lot, particularly global firms, draw on their counterparts offshore and what's being adopted offshore, whether it's flexibility of workplace, support, you know, to look after young children or older parents. There's a multitude of factors, but you draw very heavily, I think, on the global experience.
Well, I think I'm going to verbal the governor here because in a speech he gave last week, he spoke at length about underutilisation of labour and looked at trends in rising part-time participation, which, of course, has been very strong for women. And we had a very interesting conversation around whether, in fact, we stop thinking about the delineation between part-time and full-time and just think about are people working and are they working the hours that they want to work. And I think one of the things that, you know, we also had a conversation around was you know, how our training, education and training systems adopt to this, and how we make sure that people who are in and out of the labour force, whether it's women leaving to have children, whether it's people who have episodic employment, how we're making sure that the skilling and training keeps them and their skills relevant for a rapidly evolving workplace. And I think, you know, we looked at some of the stats on mobility, which were declining. So I think there's a whole mix in here about where the labour force is at and where it's going that is particularly important to women, but increasingly is going to be important to all employees who want to be in a rapidly changing workplace. Did you want to add anything else?
Yeah, I mean, we clearly need to do better here, but I want to remind you that Australia's doing actually pretty good in this area. And a third of the workforce work part-time now. That's quite high by international standards. And that's allowed more and more women to enter the labour force. Half of women work part-time, which is high by international standards. Right at the moment, more Australians as a share of the labour force are in jobs than ever been the case before. The participation rate is the highest it's ever been. So Australia's actually doing quite a good job here. The female participation rate is now above the OECD average. It's not the highest, but it's above average, and we're making progress. There's more progress to be made along the lines that Sylvain was talking about, but we are making progress.
Before Mitch, I'll just add one more thing. I'm sure you'll love this from the DCA's perspective. I mean, we all know the issue here now is increasingly inclusion rather than diversity. Inclusion gets you diversity, genuine inclusion. And if we want to be a genuinely technologically advanced country that's drawing ideas from the best and the brightest, that's where the agenda is. And if we get that right, then gender will be the byproduct of that, I think, gender diversity. Mitch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mitch Hook, two out of four this morning, that's for sure. I'd want to bring together, if I can, a couple of streams. First, Laura's opening remarks about the massive shift since the pre-Hawke era and what we're also seeing today in capital markets, and that goes to risk management. So the first thing I would say is the biggest shift in my short career has been from the collective doctrine of the government uranium unions and protectionism that we saw in the pre-Hawke era to today, where it's now about individuals' accountability and a shift to civil society collectivism. And we're seeing that in terms of risk management in the capital markets. Over the last decade, particularly in the resources sector, it used to be 80% from equities, 20% from institutions and private equity. Today, it's actually quite the reverse. So there is now less in the equities market, which is where most of the risk capital came from, and we've now got 80% of the capital coming from the institutions, particularly the pension funds and private equity. And the institutions, of course, are now going down the path of universal obligation and universal ownership and in compelling companies to have a much greater view of environmental and social stewardship. The concern that I have is that there is a less sophisticated analysis within those institutions in actually discerning and differentiating between companies. The mining companies today globally are running at 3, 4, 5 times forward consensus earnings. They're derated beyond the cyclical momentum. Whereas if you look at the ASX, it's running at, 15.8, 16.5 times forward consensus earnings. Apple and Google, much the same. So we're seeing sectors being, in fact, categorised in the collective based on perceptions. So the mining sector is treated as a whole and less of individual companies. So we've seen a movement from the risk capital coming from equities, and we're seeing a less sophisticated analysis and understanding of how to differentiate the markets run by the institutions who are now controlling a lot of economic power and wielding a lot of influence over capital markets.
Sulin.
Look, I think part of what that reflects increasingly and the lack of segregation is really what is a result of an ever low yield environment and ever lower yields everywhere. And what that's doing is it's forcing capital down the risk spectrum. And we see that right across the board. And so large institutions and investors, go in fixed income space, go further out the curve for duration, they go further down the risk spectrum. And that is a consequence, really, of unusually low global yields. And if that persists, that ongoing potential misallocation occurs. And so I think it gets harder to differentiate between sectors, gets harder to differentiate within sectors and stocks when you just have very low risk-free rates everywhere. And that is worrying, really. That begs broader questions, like I said, of, you know, whether ever lower rates is really the right response, because it does cause that misallocation of capital.
Now, I think next cab off the rank was John, and then there's a question at the back. We've got a microphone. Yeah. Leave that one there, Mitch. John?
Hi, John Daly from Grattan Institute. We did run an analysis about, well, more technically not post-budget, but pre-election promises in the Commonwealth election. It's in the conversation, but in short, the two parties are almost identical. About half the projects on their list, both by number and by value, were not on the Infrastructure Australia list at all. About half were on the list, but not yet with a business case. In other words, IA knows it's there, but has no idea whether it's a good idea. And a very, very small number, about one or two, and very small by value, actually had a business case that IA had signed off on. So that's where we are. But I wanted to ask more generally about whether additional fiscal stimulus through infrastructure is in fact realistic given where we are. So historically, Australian major spending on major road and rail projects has run around about $6 billion a year in nominal terms, jumped up to about $10 billion in the mining boom, essentially with the WA railway projects associated with the mining boom. It's then dropped back down to about $6 billion as late as about 2016. We are now running at around about $15 billion a year in major projects. So we've gone from 6 to 15. All of the states are reporting very significant capital constraints. Mm. And on macro monitors numbers, announced projects, which of course by this stage are quite likely to happen, are to go take the total to about $23 billion by 2023. So is it realistic to expect that governments are going to do even more than that?
A stunned silence.
I think what's, from my perspective, what's really important is the pipeline keeps full. You know, I wouldn't like to see kind of the level of spending on infrastructure decline. I think the economy could, at the aggregate level, could deal with a modest pickup. Whether there's the capacity to do that, I'm not sure, but what I'm sure of is the volume of activity should not decline, and to make sure that happens, you need to keep the pipeline full.
May I?
Sure.
Oh, sorry. John, I think at the same time that we're talking about fiscal constraints, we've just been talking about a global savings glut, right? And I think we are to blame as regulators, because after the 2008 financial crisis, our focus was making financial institutions like insurance companies and pension funds safer, right? But by doing that, we've imposed risk limits that make it very difficult for pension funds, insurance funds and the like, to invest in things like infrastructure, frankly. And actually, I often believe that the safety we're seeking to create is illusory, right? So what we've done is, okay, yes, we couldn't just do nothing. I would certainly agree. After the Lehman crisis, we had to make balance sheets simpler, more transparent and the like, clean up the banks. But again, enterprising investment bankers will always find a way in the shadow banking sector. So we have to be aware and humble to know that we're shifting risk elsewhere, right? So inadvertently, by stopping our pension funds, our insurance funds, from seeking higher yields in infrastructure, we've probably inadvertently shifted them into speculating on the tech bubble, for example, or on other speculative instruments. So, you know, my argument would be, we've got, you know, trillions of dollars of negative yielding government bonds. We've got a global savings club. The money is there, right? But our regulations are stopping that money from flowing into projects because of our obsession with safety and our absolute intolerance for failure and mistakes, right? So we've got to become more honest about the reality. If we talk about wanting innovation, wanting growth, wanting entrepreneurialism, we also have to become much more tolerant, in fact, even celebrate mistakes and failure. Just keep them within certain parameters, you know, better fail fast, have enough capital buffers to buffer those failures and risks. But we need to loosen up the regulations that are trapping the world's savings in these low yielding, and at the same time starving the real sector of infra financing and entrepreneurial capital.
So if John's right, I mean, I'm willing to believe he's usually right. If you're right, then if we didn't have the infrastructure programs in place now, the Australian economy would be in a lot worse shape than otherwise would be the case, which means it comes back again to the question of what drives growth. And it's not government that drives growth, it's productivity in the private sector that drives growth. So it comes back to we need reform, we need productivity growth. We need to understand what the problems are, and we need to allow flexibility in the economy. We need to invest in certain types of human, physical, social, environmental capital. So again, I'm willing to believe that we are full, but if we are, then it's a really serious set of problems that we currently have in the Australian economy.
Susan, quickly, and then we've got to...
Just quickly, I think that is right for the longer term, but if we need... I think to your question, John, the other part of that is the fiscal policy debate should be broader than just infrastructure, particularly if we need some support to the economy near term. And the bigger debate of can we do temporary targeted type measures to households, whether it's to low-income households, pensioners, retirees, unemployed. I mean, that's got to be part of the fiscal policy debate, at least shorter term, the traditional management, because we need all of the longer term supply side, but near term it might be a better use of fiscal policy to be more stimulatory, more targeted and quickly.
I could go on to my New Start pitch here, but I won't. There's a question at the back.
Thank you. This is really a follow-on from Craig Emerson's question. My name's Stephen Bartos. I'm the New South Wales Parliamentary Budget Officer. And Melinda, you mentioned the New South Wales budget. New South Wales doesn't seem to be short of projects to invest in terms of infrastructure, as we've seen in the most recent budget. But the key question is the one that Craig raised. How to ensure it's good infrastructure that is productive, because the real risk, and it is a risk for New South Wales, is massive investment in infrastructure, which gives future generations an enormous bill for maintaining infrastructure that is not delivering results. So it has to be infrastructure that does deliver results. And I think that there are some institutional mechanisms that work really well. They're not perfect in New South Wales, but they're better than nothing. My appointment as Parliamentary Budget Officer, a whole heap of proposals were put up for us to examine in advance of the election. We costed them. All of that's public, open, transparent. It's not perfect because New South Wales only employs a PBO for 1 year out of every four, but still better than nothing. There's Infrastructure New South Wales, which examines all of the infrastructure proposals, and it's not as transparent or as open as it might be, but still much better than nothing. So there are those independent mechanisms. What I think the independent mechanisms still don't build in well enough is calculation of options values associated with infrastructure investments. Are they going to be suitable for various different risks that might occur? So do they take account of, for example, roads investments, really bad investments in terms of the ratio of future maintenance to current costs? But if they take account of emergence of self-drive cars, if they take account of what's going to happen with carbon pricing, maybe building in those options values can inform your investments. That's something that we don't really do well enough, but certainly we don't do it well enough at Commonwealth level. So John's pessimistic about Infrastructure Australia, and certainly we don't see infrastructure projects being put through the Commonwealth Parliamentary Budget Office. And so if we're looking for examples of better practice, Craig, I'd commend to you our own arrangements in New South Wales.
I think the points you've made are spot on around transparency and the type of analysis that we need to be undertaking. Interestingly, the thing that no one's mentioned is, I mean, there's all this technological shift that we need to be thinking about, but how we better plan for population. Because certainly in Sydney and Melbourne, one of the key challenges was really rapid population growth with infrastructure not matching that. And then you get into a cycle where the immediate lever you pull is the immediate release of the congestion that's before you, rather than planning for what we need to build for 20 years' time. So I think that's a huge conversation, and we heard a lot about population and population planning in the lead-up to the election, and actually we haven't heard much since. Now, Blair had a question, and then question here, and then... Oh, you've got the mic, if you go first, and then...
I'm kind of jumping in a little, Melinda, and maybe it's just a suggestion for Bob and the organisers. Andrew Ethel from Infrastructure Australia. I feel like if I'd had a chance to talk a little bit earlier, we would have been able to cut across some of these issues. So Infrastructure Australia, established in 2008 by Anthony Albanese, it's under an Act of Parliament which gives us the job to do almost precisely what Craig has asked us to do. We accept business cases from proponents. The proponents are usually state governments. We work with them on what the problem is, get a really tight problem definition. We work with them on what the range of solutions could be. It's at that point that the politicians obviously jump in and tell us what the answer is before they've really understood the problem. That's democracy. And then we work through, let's look at what the solutions are and work with you through what that business case would look like. It's a very thorough process. We get criticised sometimes because it's too thorough. We don't get criticised because it's not thorough enough. There is more work which goes on at state level. The infrastructure bodies which have now been established at state level, I think, are playing a really big role in this as well. To John's point, I accept the factoid that you gave, John, although what I would say is that we took $55 billion off the infrastructure priority list because they were already underway, and we put $85 billion on it because they're new projects. So it is making a big difference. The point you made around specifically that election period, I agree with, but in the context of the broader piece of what the IPL is doing, I think that's really important. We're also just about to release our infrastructure audit, which is our five-yearly audit program, which talks about what the overall problems are across the nation in infrastructure. Next year, we'll put out our plan, which is our ideas about what you might do to solve some of those problems. And then the infrastructure priority list, et cetera, comes off the back of that as well. We're not perfect, Stephen, but we are, I think, trying to make a contribution. I'd like to think, Craig, that we're kind of doing what you want us to do. Phil, I hope we're kind of in the right space as well. the direction, let's talk about the direction. Yeah. I think
what you're hearing is more power to your arm. question over here, thank you. And this is the last question, sorry, Blair. Time has got away from us.
Peter Drysdale from the Crawford School. I want to bring this back to the state of the global economy. I think Phil fingered the key issue here, which is a fracture of confidence in global investment. The leading edge of that is the tremendous drop away in international investment, direct foreign investments dropped away. And that's connected at the hip with the fact that the two largest economies in the world are breaking the world trade orders if they don't matter, rules if they don't matter. So my question to the panel really is, what are the international economic policies postures that countries like Australia and Indonesia should be taking to address this fracture of confidence, a crisis in the global economic system?
We've got time for one response in 90 seconds or less.
International cooperation. I mean, middle powers need to get together to fill the vacuum of the large powers.
Yeah, so
In medical, in trade, in a whole range of environmental issues.
I'm going to be rude and cut across the top of us. I think in some ways we heard the answer last night. So, I mean, the way I was actually going to wrap this up is to say, I think there's consensus that there are vulnerabilities in the economy. I think there's mixed views about how balanced they are and whether we're glass half full or glass half empty. But irrespective, we're not talking about shooting the lights out. We're talking about pretty anemic growth compared to what the globe has seen and compared to what Australia has seen. Monetary policy can't do it alone. I think we all agree. And if you think that this is a crisis of investment confidence, lowering interest rates isn't going to get you there. So what we need is a massive structural reform agenda, both domestically and internationally. We've been talking about this for Europe and Japan forever, really. But we really need to bite the bullet. And where we are right now with trade, the answer was delivered last night. Economies like Australia must work with other economies like Australia, with Japan, with the EU, and actually rail against what's happening because it is not in the interests of everyone else. And we've got to get in there and figure out how we start cooperating on these things and not allow the deterioration of the rules-based system, which actually has served us so well. Tom, final word, you've got 1 minute.
No, I'm going to answer your question in my next session.
Can I just add G20? I think the G20 is a critical discussion to occur.
Yes.
And it's there at the right time, at the right place. It's in Japan, so let's see how the Japanese handle it.
Going there later this week.
Yes. So thank you.
I was at the G20 governors and finance ministers meeting 2 weeks ago, and Australia has a loud voice there supporting the open rules-based international system, and it's important that we do that. People look to us to speak up.
Absolutely.
And we do, the Treasurer does, and he's a powerful voice for the open rules-based system, and we need to find our friends and get together and amplify the power of our voice.
So, sorry, I'm going to get shot from behind otherwise. Can you join me in thanking the panel for what's been an interesting conversation?